Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the failed attempt in Yemen to rescue hostages killed by militants before U.S. Special Forces were able to free an American photojournalist and a South African working for a charity that had already paid a ransom for his release, which was due on Sunday. We will speak with an expert on Yemen, Charles Schmitz, the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies, to get an understanding of how much the government in the capital, Sana'a, is in control of this divided country that is not just a haven for the so-called Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, but appears to be caught up in a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Then, with North Korea denying involvement in the hacking of Sony Pictures while praising the hacking as a righteous deed, we will examine the apparent gap between military hacking capabilities and civilian defenses following the hacking of almost 50,000 Social Security numbers and personal details on movie stars, along with unreleased Sony movies that were made available on pirate sites. Alan Pallett, the director of research at the SANS Institute, who directs their Internet Storm Center, the early warning system for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risks in Cybersecurity study, joins us to discuss how vulnerable civilian commercial data is to military-grade attacks and what defensive measures could be taken. Then finally, we will look into the rewriting of history underway in Japan that is being encouraged by Japan's right-wing Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who, along with ultra-nationalists, are attacking the leading left-of-center newspaper Asahi Shimbun and their investigative journalist Takashi Umura, who wrote about how Chinese, Korean, Filipino, Dutch, and Australian so-called comfort women were forced to work in Imperial Army military brothels during World War II. Thomas Berger, a professor of international relations at Boston University and the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, joins us to discuss the Japanese right wing's assault on history. And joining us now is Charles Schmitz, who is the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. Dr. Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University, and has researched and written extensively on Yemen and its relationships with other nations in the Arabian Peninsula and with the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Schmitz.
Thank you.
And what is the extent to which the government in Yemen really is in control? The president, Abdel Rabo Mansour Hadi, is backed by the Saudis. He tried to put together a so-called technocratic government, but the capital in September was overrun by the Houthi rebels, who are Shiites and who have ties to Iran. And Saudi Arabia has just suspended most of its financial aid to the impoverished neighbor in Yemen. So let's start with that question. How much is this already, this country, this divided country, already in a victim of a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
To some extent, it is the scene of a proxy war, but actually the factions that are fighting inside of Yemen are homegrown. They're not products of foreign interference. The country is very, very divided. It is a state that does not have a lot of capabilities of controlling its territory to begin with, but now the state itself, the military itself, the security apparatus itself is divided between different political factions, and so it's very incapable at this point.
But if there is this Sunni-Shiite divide, and that the Shiite rebels, the Houthi, now control the capital, the Yemenis that are supposedly working with the United States, the Sunnis, wouldn't they, in many ways, or at least elements within them, have sympathies with Al-Qaeda?
Ian, we need to back up a minute here. There are Sunni and there are Shia. The Houthi are the leadership of the Houthi is Shia, but the divide between the Sunni and Shia is not as stark as we may make it out to be. There are Shia and Sunni on either side of the various divisions inside of Yemen. It's not really based on sectarian. It's based more on, I would say, sort of political interests. So, yes, Saudi Arabia has its interests in Yemen, and Iran has its interests in Yemen. Within Yemen, the Houthi began as kind of a civil rights movement for certain sectors of the Shiite population, and they've grown significantly. They do have links to Iran, but they're not. It's not Hezbollah. It's very much a homegrown organization. So the degree to which Iran influences the Houthi is unclear. And just to give you an example of how complex the situation is, the Houthi did overrun the capital in September, but they insisted that Hadi, who's closest to the United States, there's tensions between Hadi and Saudi Arabia as well, insisted that Hadi put together a technocratic government. So their demands very much were for an effective government, not of their own choosing, that the president himself put together a technocratic government, which he did. The Houthi then moved south into areas that they don't have as many ties, not as many family ties, not as many tribal ties, not as many ties in society. And when they moved south, they encountered more resistance from local people, including from Al-Qaeda. The Houthi and Al-Qaeda are archenemies, and they're going after each other. And the Houthis have battled very fierce and bloody battles with Al-Qaeda in the southern parts of the country in the recent months.
So, but the cutoff of Saudi aid to the government, presumably significant. Saudi Arabia's been their principal source of funds, haven't they?
Well, yes. That report of cutoff of aid. There was one report by Reuters. The Saudi ambassador to Yemen denied there was a cutoff of aid, and announced the supplying of humanitarian aid, some wheat aid, food aid to displaced people in Yemen. The Saudis object to, there was supposed to be support for the Yemeni military. And the Yemeni military is divided, as I said. The Houthi control a lot of the Yemeni military. And what the Saudis did not want to do is to be supplying military support to the Houthis. So they were withdrawing that aid. But other aid they are continuing with. So it's not a complete abandonment. The Saudis would not completely abandon Yemen at this point.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Schmitz, who is the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. Dr. Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University and has researched and written extensively on Yemen and its relationship with other nations on the Arabian Peninsula and with the United States. So it's into this divided country that the United States sends a rescue mission of special forces to rescue an American photojournalist, and apparently they didn't know that he was also being held with a South African aid worker whose charity had already paid a ransom for his release, and he was due to be released the day after the raid took place. So how much at a disadvantage is the United States, and who are they working with?
The President Hadi is a very strong supporter of the United States. He, like no one else in Yemen, has given the U.S. support for drone strikes and intelligence. And the United States has lots of ties with the Yemeni military. The United States has trained not so much the regular military, but the counterterrorism, the Coast Guard, border surveillance. The United States has worked a lot. The United States has people in Yemen. There is U.S. military as advisors and observers and whatnot in Yemen. So this is not new for the United States. They have lots of people they cooperate with inside of Yemen.
Well, but the American photojournalist Luke Summers was kidnapped going to a supermarket in the capital, wasn't he?
Oh yes. In the last 3 years or so, 3 or 4 years, kidnapping in Yemen has taken a dangerous turn. Kidnapping in Yemen used to be kind of an affair where a local group, maybe a tribe, a village, would kidnap someone, a foreigner, to get the government's attention, but the person kidnapped would be treated as a guest of honor and would be released in a number of days or weeks or something like this. But with the rise of Al-Qaeda and the paying of very high ransoms, it's become kind of a network of criminal groups, rogue security elements in Al-Qaeda that take hostages and then demand these very high ransoms of $3-4 million dollars. And it's been a significant fundraiser for Al-Qaeda in Yemen.
So how much is the U.S. military and the intelligence services working with the Houthis, the Shiites, they may not be surrogates of Iran like Hezbollah, but they certainly have connections to Iran. And then on the other side, you know, Saudi Arabia has always had an ambivalent relationship with the Sunni extremists, including Al Qaeda. So were the Houthis helping the U.S. since they're now arch enemies of Al Qaeda?
Well, I'm sure the United States is not unhappy that Al Qaeda or that Al Houthis are taking on Al Qaeda so effectively. But I can't imagine any coordination happening between them. The United States has always been nervous about the Houthis because of their Iranian connections. They haven't opposed the Houthi. They haven't taken action against the Houthi, and the Houthi haven't taken any actions against the United States either. And so in this case, they're fighting on the same side, but I would seriously doubt there's any coordination. On the other side, the Saudis are very, very afraid of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, and they're very afraid of any kind of coordination between ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which apparently there has been some, and that for the Saudis is an absolute nightmare. So the Saudis may encourage opposition to the Houthi, but they're not about to encourage Al-Qaeda because they see Al-Qaeda in Yemen as a very dangerous threat to Saudi Arabia itself.
And are the Al-Qaeda people close to the Saudi border in that sort of lawless area?
Yeah, they. In fact, there's been a couple of skirmishes along the border with Saudi Arabia that Al-Qaeda may have been involved in. And that's precisely why the Saudis are so afraid of them, because Yemen appears to be a kind of a lawless state where Al-Qaeda can take refuge and organize, and they can easily slip into Saudi Arabia and carry out attacks, which they have in the past.
So this is one of those cases where if there is a sort of macro deal made with the U.S. and Iran via these talks that almost succeeded and now they've been extended, a lot of people say that the whole strategic picture could change in the Middle East if the U.S. and Iran buried the hatchet. And that's, of course, a big if. But this sounds like it could have ramifications in Yemen, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons that the Houthi movement has spread as quickly as it has in the last year is that the transitional government that was put together by the Gulf Cooperation Council and the United States and the Europeans has really failed to deliver anything on the street. Security has worsened. The economy has worsened. And the Houthi are promising order and stability, and to some extent they're bringing it. And they are the ones that forced this technocratic government into power. So the United States very much wants Yemen to stabilize. The Houthis may be a factor in stabilizing it. Now, that's yet to be determined whether they're able to stabilize it or further exacerbate conflicts in Yemen. So to that extent, the Houthi and the United States would have common interests. The wild card there is Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia plays a much larger role in Yemen than the United States does, and whether the Saudis can come to some kind of an agreement with Houthis or a Houthi-dominated government, that's unclear.
So you mentioned, Charles Schmidt, that the U.S. has trained Yemeni special forces and Coast Guard, etc. They have a base across the Arabian Sea there, or the Gulf of Suez in Djibouti, apparently where the drones come out of and the Marines come out of there. The Osprey aircraft that we're using, this apparently came from a ship off the coast, and you know they came in. They had to hike a long way, the SEALs, from where they were dropped off, and then apparently they just before they attacked this compound, somehow the Al-Qaeda people were alerted, and they immediately dispatched one of their people to go and kill the two hostages. And apparently by the time they got to the hostages, they were more seriously wounded, and they evacuated them, but they died, one en route and one in the hospital on the ship off the coast. So how big is the footprint there? And does the U.S. have a lot of boots on the ground? I mean, if the country is so unstable, you'd think at some point or other they may be able to capture an American.
They do have boots on the ground. The United States in advisor capacities and observer capacities, trainers. But they're very careful about where they are and keeping them secure. The coal bombing happened in Yemen, and since then the United States has been very hesitant about actually placing any kind of a base or any kind of regular American forces inside of Yemen. I think they much prefer to be in Djibouti and come in when they need be.
So just going forward then, in closing here, what's your sense of whether the U.S. can manage this situation here? I mean, is this Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula more of a problem for the Saudis than the U.S.? And if so, why don't the Saudis take care of it?
So the Saudis have been working very hard to take care of it. They had an intelligence officer that penetrated deep into Al-Qaeda and was able to successfully block one of the plots. The Saudis very much want to stop Al-Qaeda in Yemen and the doing. Yemen's future is really not in the hands of the Saudis or the United States. Yemen's future is really in the hands of the Yemeni. And this is one of these cases where it sort of shows the limits to foreign intervention in the country. Your country has to kind of put itself back together. Certainly foreign powers can help, but the country has to put it back together. And at this point, Yemen is still trying to determine its own future.
But it's devoid of natural resources, as far as I can tell, including water.
Well, it has tremendous labor power. There's a lot of Yemeni, and they're very industrious. And, given the opportunity, they certainly can build a country. Yes, water resources are very scarce, and water is one of them. But it's a question of managing the resources. Once they're managed, then, Yemen can put itself to work and right its economy.
And so you don't see, then, this proxy war tearing the country apart any further?
No, it possibly could tear. It could get worse. But I would say that the elements that are fighting are inside of Yemen more than outside of Yemen. I would say that again, the Yemenis need to resolve their own conflicts, and the foreign powers have some influence over it, but it's really a domestic affair inside of Yemen more than a proxy war.
But it's certainly not a country that you should visit as a tourist, right? Particularly if you're going to get snatched and end up...
No tourism. Yemen is an absolutely beautiful country, and one of the assets they have is potential for tourism, but that's going to be on hold for a while, I think.
Well, Charles Schmitz, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Schmitz, who is the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. Dr. Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University and has researched and written extensively on Yemen and its relationship with other nations on the Arabian Peninsula and with the United States. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into the gap between military hacking capabilities and civilian defenses. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alan Paller, who's Director of Research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree-granting institution, and the Principal Cyber Security Training School. Alan directs SANS research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the Early Warning System for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risks in Cybersecurity Study. Alan has testified several times before both House and Senate committees. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Paller.
Thank you, Ian.
And the hack against Sony Pictures here in Los Angeles, where more than 47,000 current and former employees, their social security numbers, salaries, home addresses, etc., have been released online, and movies from Sony Studios have been released to pirate sites. The damage is fairly extraordinary, so it leads you to ask the question, there appears to be a massive gap between military capabilities from countries like North Korea and the companies here in the United States in terms of their defenses. So is there a lag between civilian defenses and military capabilities?
There has been a lag for the last 4 or 5 years. The military learned back half a decade ago that their command and control systems were being taken over, which caused massive problems for defending yourself when you don't control your own weapons. And now the businesses in America are finding out that they don't control their own computers, and it's a wake-up moment.
And given that the military have known this for some time, why do you think it's just that these big companies never thought this would happen to them? I'm surprised at how apparently lackadaisical they are in terms of the vulnerabilities, given the cost to Sony from this hack.
I think they recognize vulnerabilities quite clearly. What they didn't see was how big the damage could be. The Defense Department didn't see it earlier either until it actually happened. Mostly what you saw in commercial attacks was release of personally identifiable information. And it costs money to clean that up. But for the most part, the businesses weren't badly damaged. Now you're seeing actual damage to the economics of the business and terrible damage to their relationship with their employees and the actors and actresses. That's an existential attack. And it changes your thinking about cybersecurity. You decide to do something about it. That's what DOD did 4 or 5 years ago. That's what commercial America will start doing as each piece of industry feels the pain.
Well, it does seem, though, that is the key to this, that early detection of malware? In other words, if this malware is allowed to lurk for a long time, that's when it really does the damage, right? So is that the advantage that the military have, that they figured out how to identify malware earlier than civilian defenses have?
That's a key insight that a lot of commercial companies haven't actually reached yet, that they actually can't stop the attackers from getting in. And the current strategy they have to implement is a way to get them out fast, find them fast, get them out fast, find out what damage they did, clean it up all in seconds or minutes, not in days, weeks, or months. The average utility that was found to be infected had been infected for 15 months before it was discovered. That's just crazy. Too much damage can be done.
So the North Koreans have denied hacking Sony, but they've called it a righteous deed. And apparently this malware has been made on a machine with Korean language settings. And on Thursday, Russian cybersecurity company Kaspersky Lab, they announced a report saying that the hack was similar to the hacks last year, attacks on South Korea, which attacked South Korean banks and media companies, and that was identified as coming from North Korea. So I'm kind of surprised that people aren't being more categorical about where this is coming from. I mean, when the North Koreans say that they didn't hack it, but it's a righteous hack, and they are attacking this movie, The Interview, because the film hurts the dignity of the supreme leadership, it's pretty hard not to attribute this to North Korea.
Well, the Kaspersky people do very good research, and if they saw hard similarities between the attacks, that's a lot of evidence that it might have come. And you certainly have all the reasons you just described for why it might have come from the North Koreans. And there are very few people who would want to make it look like it came from the North Koreans, meaning other nations that hate them. So it's illogical to think that it was someone else, but it just as well could have been someone else.
Again, I'm speaking with Alan Powler, who's the Director of Research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree granting institution, and the Principal Cybersecurity Training School. Alan directs SANS research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the Early Warning System for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risk in Cybersecurity Study. Alan has testified several times before both House and Senate committees. So, Alan, given the damage that's been done here, we already know that there's a vast sort of underground in internet crime that I think is much bigger than we acknowledge. And I remember talking to you once, you explaining to me how these hackers break into these vast computer systems and commercial entities and use what you described as a zombie, use them as zombies. In this case, about 50,000 Social Security numbers. There have been hacks against big retail giants where hundreds of thousands of customers' data has been released. And I understand that this is just brokered and sold, that there's a huge kind of flea market, if you will, for cybercrime.
Yeah, there are online bazaars where you can ask for credit cards with certain levels of credit on them. So I only want credit cards that have more than $1,000 of active credit and that are alive right now. And they run tests on the account and then sell them to you, meaning it's a very sophisticated buying and selling operation. And the cyber crime business has separated between the gatherers of the data and the processors of the data and the sellers of the data. So it's not just a flea market, it's a sophisticated multi-layered marketing program. But I think what you found here isn't the organized crime side of it. What you found here is the use of military grade offense against non-military grade defense. Because you're talking about if you believe that it is the nation state, I'm saying, taking your hypothesis that it is the North Koreans, then it is the same tools the North Koreans would be using in a military exercise. And there's simply an enormous amount of money and preparation that goes into the tools that make them much more difficult to find once they get over the barriers. And it's very easy for those tools to go through the barriers that most commercial organizations have. So the point I'm trying to make is it's a tougher opponent that you're dealing with, which is why you have to spend much more of your focus on getting the skills of your people up to finding those infections that have gotten through. If you still think that your job is compliance and stopping attackers before they get in, you're 10 years out of date and you ought to be replaced.
So what is, though, the confluence between military and criminal hacking? Because, you know, in many ways, Russia itself has become a criminal state. Putin runs a kleptocracy, which he regulates. The essential, I mean, what's beneath the surface, I think, in the problems between the EU and the US and Russia over Ukraine, etc., more than anything seems to have to do with a choice between two kinds of governments. What the Russians are offering are gangster government, you know, with that gangster that was running Ukraine that got booted out. And the same in Moldova and Abkhazia and others. You know, they're basically, and Crimea is now run by gangsters. So Putin is offering a kind of gangster rule, and that's why he doesn't want the EU to have any traction there, because people obviously want to live in a peaceful, law-abiding society. But this is I'm getting a little long-winded here, but the earlier attacks of, several years ago, against, I think, Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia, which were attributed to the Russian military. They also do commercial damage. So my understanding is that the FSB does, you know, and I guess the US does too to some extent, hire hackers who may well be involved in criminal activities. So how do you, you know, pass these things out?
There there's an incestuous relationship in Russia we know about because of Joe Mann's book, I think it was called Fatal System Error, but it documented the search for the people who had done one of the really big crimes and found them terribly, completely protected by the Russian government. So the incestuousness is documented. You also have seen governments hire, Chinese governments, for example, hire small firms to do cyber work. And when those firms aren't doing cyber work for the government, they're doing cyber work for crime organizations. So there's an overlap in techniques between the criminal groups and the government. I think the way to break it down is money. If you're a very large-scale organized crime group, you have tens of millions of dollars that you can invest in new technology. And that technology can be overwhelming to people who are taking cybersecurity for granted. If you're a government, you also have tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. So where I'm going with this is your opponent is either somebody who gets an attack tool off the internet and tries it and doesn't have any money, or he or she is very well funded. And the very well funded ones are the ones that are causing all the damage right now.
So when you have, though, these kind of loose arrangements between government and military offensive cyber operations, and of course defensive as well, and criminals who are also highly organized and well-funded, as you pointed out. Is there anything going on in this on our side that's similar? I mean, I've heard reports that, you know, some teenage hackers have been caught by the FBI and put to work by the NSA. Is that apocryphal or is there some truth to that?
Most of the people who were early pioneers in sort of good cybersecurity defense experimented early, doing things that they might not have been appreciated for, like getting into their teachers' computers to see tests or changing grades or something else that was a crime, but didn't push them over into the felony side. Today, most of the people working in defense are not that. Most of them working in defense came up through education programs and wanting to work, but there is still a crossover. Millions of young people are doing things on the internet that they shouldn't be doing. In fact, the internet is sort of the video games of this decade, and they're experimenting, they're exploring, they're trying to get into machines they shouldn't be trying to get into. They're getting data on friends or enemies. There's just a lot of exercise of exuberance and exploration that would be considered bad behavior. Those people are, some of them, are very skilled. And as long as we get them before they go over the line and start making a bunch of money, I think they're an extraordinarily great source of talent. Once they have sort of gotten the taste of blood in their mouths, we don't seem to be able to bring him back. The guy who did the TJ Maxx attack was an example. He was working for the Secret Service when he did that attack, meaning the Secret Service thought they had converted him, but they didn't. And that's been my experience, that once these, you call them hackers, but once they've become felons or should have been convicted of a felony, they're gone for the most part. I don't mean they all are, but we haven't seen a lot of them coming back and working wonderfully for the good guys. So the answer is yes, they're hiring a lot of people who are hackers, but I don't think they're hiring very many people who were convicted of or found to have done sort of substantial crimes.
So why?
Or they shouldn't be. They are.
So Alan Pala, why is it then that this happens in the first place? I know it sounds like a dumb question, but it's obvious that because everybody uses the internet, it makes everybody equally vulnerable. And when you talk about entering, a malware entering, it's like breaking and entering. And apparently everybody is vulnerable to it. I know, for example, the CIA doesn't use the net. They're sealed off because they're afraid of intrusions. So Is that how it is, that it comes with the territory? If you use the Internet, you're automatically vulnerable?
All the computers that are put on the Internet are facing a wave of automated attacks. Even if they have nothing of interest, their machines are being pounded to see if they can be taken over to be used as zombies in denial-of-service attacks or spam things, so that every computer on the Internet is subject to that. We did for years, we did an analysis of how many minutes a computer, just a new computer you bought from Best Buy, would stay on the Internet before it was infected, and it was running about 21 minutes, which was less time than it took to download the updates that you needed to protect it. So there was sort of no way out if you bought your computers not pre-configured securely. But that answers the question of why it happens. It happens because the computer that we bought has the vulnerability built in and doesn't have a basic defense. It would be as if cars were sold to us where you couldn't turn the engine off and you couldn't lock the doors and you were parking it in a bad neighborhood. It just wouldn't last long. So you can say, well, that's our fault. We should force pull the key out and lock the doors, put a padlock on our doors. And just, no, the cars ought to be sold safely. And that has happened over the last 30 years, but computers haven't been sold safely. Computers have been sold for convenience, which is economically wonderful, but it carried with it this sense that the car is turned on and the doors are unlocked and you're out there on the Internet. The solution turns out to not be that hard. And we actually have a model for it now, which we didn't have for years. The App Store at Apple forces every program that you can install on your iPhone to have gone through a test before it goes on your iPhone. And that avoids somebody sending you a message with a piece of software that the iPhone then installs the way your PC does. Mm-hmm. And it's called whitelisting. But it's done with an App Store model, and that's the short-term, 4 or 5 year solution to this problem. That we, instead of buying a computer where anything that we get can install a piece of software on it and take it over and use it for anything, no piece of software will be able to be installed on our computers unless they have been checked for some things. So that you don't have to worry about opening that email, because the email can't install something on your machine. It's not a perfect solution. It's simply a wonderful solution. Nothing in this field is perfect. We're in the middle of an arms race that'll last for 30 or 40 more years. But it's a wonderful solution for making the jobs of the bad guys hard.
Well, just in closing, Alan Pallett, when you talk about zombies, it seems to me that what you're talking about here, when everybody's computer is being attacked constantly, and that it's as though the hackers use what the military refer to as force multipliers, that they somehow co-opt thousands of other computers, big companies' computers, and use them against you. Just describe how that works.
How they take it over, or how they use it after they take it over?
Yeah, how they take it over and how they use it, and the term zombie, how it applies to that.
All right. The fundamental way that they come into your machine is by either a drive-by attack or a phishing attack. Drive-by attack means they have taken over a website that you might go to and infected it, so that when your computer goes and visits that website, you assume you're in a safe environment, but the website is actually infecting your machine and putting a piece of software on it that then contacts the attacker and asks for instructions. So one way is called the drive-by. You're driving by a website and you get infected. The other one's called phishing, where they send you an email or an instant message and say, hey, here's a new picture of somebody that's hot in the news. And you open the picture, and inside the picture is an infection. Or you open an Excel spreadsheet that says, here are the salaries of all of the top people in our company that's never been public. You open it, and that Excel spreadsheet has an infection in it. Those are the things you stop with whitelisting, by the way. But that's how your machine gets infected. Once it's infected, the machine goes out to the mothership. They go out to the machine that's controlled by the bad guys. So that machine is not actually in the bad guy's site. It's another zombie that they've taken over. And they go out to that machine to get instructions on what to do. and there's a constant flow back and forth where the zombie, if it's inside Sony, for example, where that program on a computer inside Sony is looking around for the data that they want to steal, grabbing it, compressing it, and sending it off to the mothership. Does that do any good on explanation?
Yeah, I'm getting a handle on it. Just the idea that that so much that the hackers can use the system so much against you and co-opt so much within the internet and within cyberspaces.
But you see immediately why the whitelisting idea works, because it stops the infection from ever installing the program on your machine
right.
in the first place.
Right.
And we can't get Microsoft to install software with that built in, but Apple's way ahead, and we're hoping that's a move that other software companies will implement at scale.
Well, Alan Peller, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome, Ian. Thanks for inviting me.
Again, I've been speaking with Alan Peller, who's the Director of Research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree-granting institution, and the Principal Cybersecurity Training School. Alan directs SANS research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the Early Warning System for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risks in Cybersecurity Study. Alan has testified several times before both the House and Senate committees. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the Japanese right wing's assault on history. And all the truth of energy. We are the robots. We are the robots. We are the robots. We are the robots. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Berger, a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations, and comparative government in East Asia. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan, and is co-editor of Japan in International Politics, Beyond the Reactive State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Berger.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
And it looks as if there's a campaign underway in Japan to rewrite history, and it seems that it's being encouraged by Japan's right-leaning Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe. I mean,
this is nothing new, per se. I mean, there have been differences, very different views on history in Japan for a long, long time. But these issues tend to become intensified when you have a conservative government. And the Abe government, Abe Shinzo himself, is very deeply committed, I think, both personally in terms of the people who are backing him, his constituents, to a point of view of history that is revisionist, that questions sort of the way in which we've assigned guilt for the events of before 1945 in Asia-Pacific.
So how much is Prime Minister Abe allied with the ultranationalists who are attacking the leading left-of-center newspaper, Asahi Shimbun, and their investigative journalist, Takashi Yumura, who wrote about how Chinese, Korean, Filipino, Dutch, and Australian so-called comfort women were forced to work in Imperial Army military brothels during World War II?
Well, I don't think that Abe is a ultranationalist in the sense that he wants to go back to some kind of authoritarian, emperor-worshipping, pre-World War II type of system. And while there are some people who I have who are quite ultra-nationalist in their views in Japan, I don't think that Abe directly controls or directs this campaign. But however, he does sympathize with a view which is more positive, a kind of more positive view of Japanese history, modern Japanese history and P-1945 history, and he has created an atmosphere which encourages a deeply conservative and in some cases outright revisionist kind of point of view of surfacing, and which criticizes the other side. That is, there are also people, and that's important to understand, in Japan who have a very different understanding of Japanese history, who are much more critical of Imperial Japan and its history. And I think right now we are seeing a real concerted and sustained effort to discredit those people.
Well, the ultranationalists are really going after the investigative journalist for Asahi Shimbun. I mean, to the point where he's being, you know, has to sort of hide out, and they're attacking his workplace. They've called upon his daughter to commit suicide.
Yes, I mean, there's been absolutely outrageous behavior which has taken place, especially targeting Mr. Uemura, who is a former Asahi newspaper director, and it's caused him to. He was a former reporter at Asahi newspaper. He reported on these issues extensively in the 1990s. He retired to become a professor at a Japanese university, and they have effectively driven him from his position. Now, I do want to point out that, and this is a terrible situation, I do want to point out that the Japanese government, including the chief cabinet secretary, Mr. Suga, have criticized this. I mean, while they, and there are many conservative Japanese who, while they are, they disagree with the sort of liberal perspective on Japanese history, are appalled and have criticized the kind of tactics which are used by the ultra-right. But it is taking place, and this is a terrible situation.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Berg, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations, and comparative government in East Asia. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan, and is co-editor of Japan in International Politics Beyond the Reactive States. So if Abe is not orchestrating or necessarily in bed with the ultranationalists, I don't imagine he's sorry to see Asahi Shimbun being attacked, and I believe its readership has gone down. It's the only sort of left-of-center paper in Japan, isn't it?
No, there are other papers which I would describe as being also center or even left of center. It depends on the issue, and even on the, and even in this case, some of the right of center papers, the major sort of right of center paper in Japan is the Yomiuri newspaper, has actually supported Asahi newspaper on the sort of freedom of speech grounds. So, and on the historical issue, I should also add that the head of the Yomiuri. There are conservatives in Japan who would disagree with this kind of ultra-nationalist campaign, would disagree with it because of its implications for democracy, and they also think that this kind of campaign, frankly, makes Japan look bad. So I think there are a lot of mainstream people who are likewise appalled, and right-of-center people who are likewise appalled by this situation.
So there are these peculiar events going on in Japan and in North Korea because of Hollywood movies.
Yes.
And one, of course, is The Interview, which Kim Jong-un seems to be absolutely incensed over. And it's pretty clear that the North Koreans hacked into Sony Pictures and cost them a lot of money in terms of releasing films that hadn't been released to pirate sites. And then you've got this other film directed by Angelina Jolie called Unbroken, which is a true story of an American POW held by the Japanese during World War II and who was brutally treated, as was the case with most prisoners of war. And it looks as though they're not going to release it in Japan. I mean, I find it kind of ironic, isn't it, that that Kim Jong-un, you know, is what's going on in the North Korea, I think, has very little to do with communism and a lot to do with kind of Imperial Japanese emperor worship. Isn't there an analogy there?
A number of people have made that point. I'm not an expert on North Korea, but Bruce Cummings, who's a well-known historian of Korean history at the University of Chicago, wrote quite interestingly about the parallels between the Japanese cult of emperor worship in the pre-1945 period and the way in which you have a kind of state adulation of the Kim family in North Korea today. So, yeah, it is kind of disturbing. I would be careful to, you know, not quite put the Japanese. One of the reasons with regard to the Unbroken movie not being shown, and we've seen this a couple of times before, is that also theater owners are not themselves necessarily right-wingers or ultra-nationalists, but they don't want to attract that kind of attention. And so they just want to avoid having a controversial issue which might lead to right-wing thugs sort of demonstrating outside of the theater and making a nuisance of themselves. So they just don't want to be bothered with it.
Well, just in closing, Thomas Berger,
sure.
Why is it that, and you've studied both countries in terms of post-war guilt, if you will, Japan and Germany, why is it that the Germans have gone through a very comprehensive re-education program about Nazi atrocities in World War II, and the country itself seems to be at peace, and you've had sort of truth and reconciliation, for the want of a better description. But yet on the Japanese side, it just festers forever, and you've got these denialists. They strike me as being about as insane in many ways as these climate change deniers, you know?
Well, it's an excellent question, and one of which, you know, I could become very boring about very quickly. I'll just plug my book and say, you know, for a detailed answer, look at my work on this subject. But the sort of shorter, sort of closer to a bumper sticker version of this is that Germany and Japan have been in very different kinds of positions since the end of World War II, and those differences continue today. Germany was also very reluctant. If you know that history of the 1940s and 50s and 60s, Germany was also very reluctant to really confront the scale of what was committed by Germans and in Germany's name. And this was it took a long time for the Germans to come to terms with that issue. The reason that they did so, I mean, there were a number of reasons. There were moral considerations. There was leadership by individual German leaders, including Adenauer and Willy Brandt. And one important factor was because they had to. They were embedded in a multilateral Europe which was tied together with institutions economically by the European Economic Community, today the EU, and militarily by NATO. And if they were going to work with countries, which included countries which had been brutalized by Germany during the Second World War, they had to confront these issues. And they did. And I would say, furthermore, to their credit, over time, that sense of contrition, that sort of coming to terms with the darker side of their history, has become deeply rooted in German political culture today. Now, and they have been rewarded for this, I might add, as well. That is, to the extent that we've been able to have peaceful, cooperative relations in Europe, there are a number of factors which contribute to it, but certainly Germany's stance on history was an important one which made that possible. Japan, in contrast, after World War II, there were no binding multilateral institutions. The Japanese Empire had collapsed. In many ways, Japan had been kicked out of Asia, and Japan turned away from Asia, where most of the atrocities had taken place during the pre-1945 period. There was no European Economic Community. There was no NATO. There were ties and relations of very sort, but they were no longer as deep and as profound as the ones in which Germany found itself. So the Japanese, in some ways, had no incentive to come to terms with these issues. That began to change in the 1970s and 1980s, but only partially. China opened up to the outside world under first Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping, the Japanese actually began to talk more about the Nanjing Massacre and other types of atrocities. As Korea became more important to Japan in the 1980s and 1990s, likewise, we saw the Japanese trying to come to terms with this. And we saw really in the 1990s a almost sort of European, almost German, Austrian-style effort to try to come to terms with this history. Unfortunately, it didn't go too far. It did not reach fruition. And the reason that it didn't reach fruition were a couple of reasons, but one reason is that Asia remains uncoordinated. There are deep geopolitical rivalries. And another reason is because, in the meantime, history of issue has been polarized. The issue of how you view history is closely tied to issues such as national defense and national security, with the left always taking a sort of tough, critical view on Japanese history and opposing Japanese rearmament or increased Japanese military role in the world, including increased Japanese contribution to international security, and the right, on the other hand, being very much associated with a more positive, revisionist view of Japanese history and imperial history, playing down the crimes of the past and conversely supporting a more active Japanese in contribution to international security and a larger military role. So, you know, domestic politics have gotten tied in and, with these kinds of left versus right issues and remain more polarized in Japan than is true in Germany. And that is reinforced by an international environment where the Japanese are not rewarded and have been unable to pursue the possibilities of reconciliation in the way that the Germans have. And this has created, this has become highly dysfunctional at this point in time, since really it's been dysfunctional for a while, but since we've entered the 21st century, the sort of tensions have increased over historical issues and has spilled over into other areas. So, you know, Korea and Japan should be cooperating on defense and security issues, but they are at loggerheads over the comfort women and with it the closely related, historically laden issue of Takeshima Dokdo. The Chinese and the Japanese, while they aren't likely to cooperate so closely, have every reason to want to, you know, avoid potential strategic problems from escalating and preventing them from pursuing a very important and for both sides beneficial economic and political relationship. But instead, we have these recriminations over the Nanjing massacre. The Chinese have been producing, by the way, film after film about this in recent years. If you look at Chinese TV, the sort of anti-Japanese sentiment is absolutely startling. And those disagreements over history and these recriminations have also spilled over into territorial disputes in the East China Seas over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands, which are actually taking on alarming dimensions. So history issue has, and sadly enough, while you know the history of World War II fades further and further back in time, the generation of people who actually experienced it are slowly passing from the scene, but the impact of that history in the East Asian context, because of this unfortunate sort of international domestic political structure, is increasing.
Well, Thomas Berger, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
All right. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Berger, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations, and comparative government in East Asia. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan, and is co-editor of Japan in International Politics Beyond the Reactive State. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.